From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. This morning on Twitter, President Trump responded for the first time to his lawyer Michael Cohen's sentencing to 36 months in prison for federal crimes that include making hush money payments right before the 2016 election to two women who claim to have had affairs with Trump. Trump wrote today, "I never directed Michael Cohen to break the law, and I did nothing wrong with respect to campaign finance laws." Federal prosecutors haven't directly accused Trump of a crime, and it's not clear under Justice Department protocol that they could bring any criminal charges against a sitting president. Well, joining us now is Congressman Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California, likely incoming chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
And when you take in the news about Cohen, plus the news that the publisher of the National Enquirer, a longtime Trump supporter, has agreed to tell prosecutors everything he knows about hush money payments his company made for the Trump campaign to suppress a woman's story and prevent it from influencing the election, where do you think we are?
Well, I think where we are is the Justice Department has asserted the view that a campaign finance violation scheme, a fraudulent scheme that may have an influence on the outcome of that election, was coordinated and directed by the now president of the United States. And that's a pretty startling conclusion. But more than that, through the agreement with AMI, the parent of the National Enquirer, it is no longer just Michael Cohen's word. It is the word of other witnesses as well, that not only were these payments made, not only was individual one or Donald Trump in the know, but that the principal purpose of these payments was influencing the election. Of course, that's key because that undercuts what Donald Trump is saying, that these payments had nothing to do with the election.
Well, and he says that this was a private transaction, not an illegal campaign contribution. This is an argument that former presidential candidate John Edwards made, and he was acquitted on one charge of accepting illegal campaign contributions. The jury couldn't reach a verdict on the other charges. I mean, does Trump have a good defense there if that's what he's saying, that this was private, it wasn't a campaign contribution?
I don't think so. I think the problem in the Edwards case was a question of proof. Could they prove that these payments were intended to influence the election? Here it appears that they can, that there are ample witnesses and corroborating evidence that along with the timing of this right on the eve of the election, it's quite clear exactly what the object was. And in terms of the president's comments, I think he's demonstrated time and time again, you really can't rely on anything he has to say about this because, of course, he maintained for a long time that he knew nothing of these payments. And now we have heard recordings of him discussing these payments at the time with Michael Cohen. So he's not exactly a credible source on any of this.
What about the idea that the president can't be indicted? You want the Justice Department to change current guidelines that have been in place since the Nixon administration that say that, they say, would unconstitutionally undermine the executive branch to indict a sitting president. What about that?
Well, there's no constitutional prohibition on indicting the sitting president. The Department of Justice, through its Office of Legal Counsel, has opined in opinions which are not statutory or constitutional. They're merely the opinion of a lawyer at the Justice Department that that should not be done while the president is in office. But that conflicts in this circumstance with the potential that the statute of limitations may run on these serious crimes and indeed crimes that may have helped him obtain office. And it cannot be the policy of the Department of Justice that a president is above the law or that if the president remains in office long enough, he can escape the jailer simply by duration in office. It can't be the policy of the Justice Department. And so I do think they may need to reconsider that policy. It may be they will want to wait and see whether this question is mooted. If the president isn't reelected and the statute of limitations is not an issue, then maybe it's a moot point. But I think the whole issue really needs to be examined, reexamined by the Justice Department.
You think he should be indicted?
Well, I certainly think that if the Justice Department believes that what Michael Cohen did justifies his going to jail for a long time, that you cannot make the argument that somehow that doesn't apply to Donald Trump. What the Justice Department had to say about Michael Cohen is that while people out there in their everyday lives were participating in the political process by making phone calls or walking precincts or hanging door hangers on doorknobs, the rich and powerful were operating by a different set of rules. And because of this, they needed to make an example of Michael Cohen. That same argument applies with even greater force to the individual that was identified as coordinating and directing the scheme. So, yes, I think every argument the Justice Department has made for putting Michael Cohen in jail applies to Donald Trump.
That is Congressman Adam Schiff, Democrat of California. Congressman, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, we have this update now on a story that stunned many, the news that some diabetics are rationing their life-saving drug insulin because of the high cost. The average price of insulin has nearly tripled in the past decade. In November, we spoke with Antoinette Warsham. Her daughter died at 22 because she was rationing her insulin. Antoinette has joined mothers like Nicole Smith-Holt in protesting outside insulin manufacturers with the group Right Care Alliance. Well, on Tuesday, Nicole Smith-Holt and her husband, James Holt Jr., spoke to Minnesota lawmakers at the state capitol about losing their son, Alec, at 26.
Can you even imagine what it was like to tell people that your son died at 26 because he struggled to afford the one medicine they created to save his life?
Alec was pronounced dead on the scene. The official cause of death was diabetic ketoacidosis.
Well, now Minnesota lawmakers are considering a bill that would include triggering some sort of mechanism at the pharmacy counter that would keep someone from walking away if they can't pay. Minnesota Representative-elect Michael Howard joins us now. Representative Howard, in October, your state launched a lawsuit against the insulin manufacturers Sanofi, Novo Nordisk, and Eli Lilly. So you were aware of this?
Absolutely. And it's an issue that Minnesotans and Americans across the country deal with, you know, a daily basis. And someone mentioned for folks with type 1 diabetes, insulin is not a cure. It is life support. And it's life support that far too many people don't have access to afford it. We've seen prices go over the last 20 years from about $20 a vial to $300 and $400 a vial. And there's a greater recognition, you know, at the state and federal level, that we need to do something about it and take some action.
Well, the state lawsuit alleges that companies are setting high list prices while offering rebates to, let's say, pharmacy benefit managers who buy in bulk. Two other states, Washington and New Mexico, are also launching investigations. Well, meantime, your state and you have introduced a bill, the Alec Smith Emergency Insulin Act. It's in honor of the Smith-Holtz son. What is the purpose of that bill?
The purpose of the Alec Smith Emergency Insulin Act is to make sure that Alec's story doesn't happen to another in Minnesota. Alec went into his pharmacy and couldn't afford the $1,300 tab to fill his insulin. He had $1,000 in his bank account, and he left empty-handed, and a few days later, he was gone. We want to start with the premise that no one in Minnesota should lack access to life-saving insulin that they need because they can't afford it.
Well, the bill would authorize the state to buy insulin in bulk so that it can be provided to people who are on low-income programs and, or, you know, the elderly, or those who, as you said, Alec was working.
Yes, Alec had a full-time job. He was making $40,000 a year. And in some ways, he fits in that donut hole of folks that have an income, but the access to affordable care and insulin is beyond their means and forces choices like rationing insulin or should I pay my rent or take my medicine. Yeah. There's some evidence that one in four folks are rationing their insulin based on their ability to pay. And so we're looking at a variety of mechanisms, but starting from the premise, we need to reduce that barrier of cost for folks and also hold the prescription drug manufacturers accountable for the prices that continue to skyrocket.
So, again, you'll buy it in bulk because, as the lawsuit contends, it's cheaper that way. But how are you hoping to get it to the diabetics? Because when you go to the pharmacy to get insulin, you usually need it. So what will trigger someone being able to access this?
We're looking at some variety of mechanisms, whether there's, you know, a test from patients that they're unable to afford the insulin, and working with pharmacies to make sure that we can get insulin into the hands of folks. And then on the back end, on the funding source, looking at the drug manufacturers who are seeing billions of dollars of profits to be held accountable and to fund this program.
Well, as we said, the lawsuits contend that the companies are price fixing. They dismiss that. And Eli Lilly, again, one of the three companies that produces insulin, blames the problem on people's high deductible health insurance. We also know that young people are getting kicked off their parents' coverage at 26 under Obamacare. So in going off and buying their own insurance, maybe they're getting a cheaper plan with high deductible, or they're not affording any insurance at all. So the companies seem to be saying this is an insurance problem.
Yeah, and Alec is one of those that he fell off his parents' insurance at 26. And his story does highlight a healthcare system overall that is broken. But James and Nicole will keep fighting until we make insulin more affordable for folks and to prevent what happened to Alec to happen to another person. It should never happen again. And I want to work with James and Nicole to make sure it doesn't in Minnesota or hopefully anywhere.
Representative-elect Howard, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Most people know actor Richard Madden as Robb Stark in the HBO series Game of Thrones.
Tell Lord Tywin, winter is coming for him.
Now he's the star of the Netflix show Bodyguard, playing Sergeant David Budd, a police officer who stops a terrorist attack and is assigned to protect the UK's Home Secretary.
I was in Afghanistan. Some mates get killed, nearly got killed myself for what? Nothing. Politicians, cowards and liars, ours and theirs. People full of talk that will never spill a drop of their own blood, but you and I... which is collateral damage.
The show is nominated for 2 Golden Globe Awards, including one for Madden as Best Actor. And Richard Madden joins us now from Los Angeles to talk about it. Richard Madden, welcome and congratulations. A lot of people probably know you best as Robb Stark, but what attracted you to this role in Bodyguard?
I think what really got me going was the kind of ambiguity of all the characters. They all live in such a grey zone of what's good and what's bad about each of them. And the script kind of plays with that idea throughout it. And that was something that was really exciting to me. I found them all very human and their motives and their motives changing throughout the show. I think that was all really exciting and it was kind of, it was a brilliant read. And that's what really drew me in.
Because your character in particular, you're a hero, but at the same time, you're doing a lot of things that maybe you shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, he can. He's a hero, and he's a villain, and he's damaged, and he's really strong, and he's a protector, and he's a victim. You know, all these kind of these brilliant contrasting things.
Well, and one of the things that this show gets into, which is very topical right now, is the idea of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, which is something that mm-hmm. your character suffers from after time serving in Afghanistan. I want to listen to a scene from the first episode when your character meets up with an old war buddy who mm-hmm. wants him to join a veterans support group.
Yes.
Always wondered if you'd turn up sometime.
Soapbox is not really my thing, mate.
That's not how you were in Helmand.
Yeah, it was a crazy time out there. Try to put all that behind me. You know, I'm making a proper go of Civvy Street.
You put PTSD on your job application, who's going to hire you? Right? Just because it's not visible.
So as you were preparing for this role, did you meet with people who have PTSD?
Yeah, I did. I spoke to some people. One of the main problems with talking to people about PTSD is people don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. The character David Budd, he's in denial about what his situation is and how that affects him and how bad it is for him, which is not as simple as we see in the movies sometimes. This, you know, someone drops a glass and they dive for cover and have mad flashbacks.
Right.
I mean, that can be an element of it, but I think there's a lot more subtleties and a lot more constant living with this disorder that's... That was more important for me to bring out and show those subtleties and how people actually carry something all day, every day with them.
So as an actor, how do you do that? How do you express the tension between those multiple layers of emotion?
I don't know. That's a very good, very difficult question to answer. I'm not really quite sure how I did it. I think it was just trying to build this character and build that into him. You know, this denial of it, but this kind of constant bursting out of it at points, which is particularly difficult for a man who's a protector and trying to kind of very much look after everyone else and not taking care of himself.
I want to listen to another clip from the first episode. Your character's boss and also lover at some point is the UK's Home Secretary, who's played by Keely Hawes. She expresses some hawkish views on the Middle East during a TV interview at the BBC. Mm-hmm. And later, your character confronts her about it. Here it is.
May I ask, ma'am, that interview you did on telly, did you mean what you said?
I'm sorry.
About the Middle East.
See, I don't only say what the people want to hear. I'm about doing the right thing and making the hard choices. The thing is, David/Dave, I don't need you to vote for me, only to protect me.
Rest assured, Mum, I'll do what's required.
You know, Richard Madden, as I was watching that, I was thinking to myself, I wonder if this could have even aired or would have even aired 10 years ago, like right after the Iraq War. This is such a feeling that a lot of people are thinking now about the sort of hawkish nature of a lot of governments in this world.
Hmm. I think that was just a really interesting in part of the story there, where he's kind of, he can't help himself. All these things that are built up inside him are kind of bursting out. And you know, he very much oversteps the line in having that conversation with her, because he can't help it. He's got a lot of rage and anger at the system and at these people that put him in that position.
What is it like to do a show like this where there are, in this case, 6 episodes and that's it for the moment?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's brilliant. I love this kind of contained element of it. It really means as an actor I can throw myself in, and very much did for a kind of 5-month shoot, which is very grueling and intense. And it, you know, if it was to be like some other show formats and 13 episodes and a kind of 9-month shoot, I'm not sure how well that would go. I loved the intensity of it and this kind of really fast paced, you know, high octane drama that we managed to get with the kind of contained 6 episodes.
How does it compare with Game of Thrones?
Very different. I mean, very different, because in Game of Thrones it's such a huge ensemble, but Bodyguard is very much cameras kind of just on my character a lot of the time, so that kind of brings a different weight and responsibility, which I mean I very much enjoyed.
Do people still stop you on the street and talk to you about being Robb Stark? I mean, has this show and its success sort of overtaken that for you?
Absolutely. People still talk to me about Robb Stark, which I love, because it was a character very close to my heart. And it's just, I mean, I'm really thankful I've had the opportunity to play David Budd and be in Bodyguard, and that's, you know, something else, so that I'm not kind of purely defined by just one show, which is really exciting for me. I've kind of tried my best since I left that show to be diverse and try different roles and different things, so I'm really glad that something like Bodyguard has done so well and travelled so well, so you know, I'm not just typecast, I suppose, as this young prince or king. I can do other things, and it's been nice to be able to express that.
Prince or king who died so gruesomely in the Red Wedding. Are you like afraid to go to weddings now, you know, because you never know what will happen?
No, not at all. Not at all. I think that's a very different world, actually.
Right. Now, people are apparently, I've been reading, talking about you as the next James Bond.
I mean, that's it's very flattering to be involved in that whole conversation. I think that's, I'm kind of blown away with that, because people have such attachment to that character and such ideas of who should play it. So it's lovely for people to be saying that, agreeing or disagreeing with it. But that's all just speculation.
And you're in the cast of the Elton John movie Rocket Man, which debuts next year. You play his one-time manager and lover, John Reed.
That's right, I do, yes.
What drew you to that role?
It was just completely different for me and really exciting. I love Dexter Fletcher, the director, and really talented actor Taron Egerton and Jamie Bell involved. And actually, it was the script is so fantastic. It's this strange, hard to describe. It's like Moulin Rouge on acid about Elton John, which, you know, I picked it up and read it and went, yeah, this is great. I'd watch that movie. So, you know, I want to be in it. And I got to play this really amazing character who is in many ways a villain, which again is different for me. And I mean, also I'm singing and dancing in it. So that's a whole different skill set required as well.
Do you like to play a villain or a good guy more?
I've played lots of good guys. I enjoy playing a bit more of a villain in Rocketman, you know, and in Bodyguard. I love playing the ambiguity and actually playing both, because sometimes he is a villain and sometimes he's a good guy. So, I mean, I'm really excited about kind of the different roles that I'm getting the opportunity to play at the moment.
So I was reading an interview that you did with the Sun newspaper, and you said that you got into acting because you were shy and overweight as a teenager, or that was part of the reason.
I wasn't overweight at that time. I was very shy. I was a very shy kid, and I got into acting to maybe into a youth theatre to try and combat that and give me a bit of confidence before I went to high school, and that's really where my kind of acting career started. I got a film when I was 11, and then a TV show for a few years, which took me out of school. And it kind of rolled on from there.
And what's been the toughest moment for you over the years?
The toughest moment? I mean
it can be a tough career, right? You're always auditioning.
It can be a tough career. I think I did a good... I've been doing a lot of theatre for many years and very much wanted to get into to camera acting and more television and film stuff. And I think in the UK it can be very much one or the other when you're starting out. You kind of... You can only be in one of the circles a lot of the time. And I made a deliberate effort to stop theatre for a while and focus on trying to get camera work. And actually I was out of work for about 10 months and had very little money. Actually my last money I'd spent on my rent, and I was going to have to go back and move in with my parents. And that was a really tough, depressing time. And then right at the end of that 10 months I got cast in this show called Game of Thrones. That changed the game for me a bit. So one of the best things that happened in my life came out of one of these darkest moments.
And do you still watch Game of Thrones, even though you're dead on the show?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I love it. I watch it as soon as it's out, yeah.
They don't give you the script beforehand to tell you what's going to happen?
No, thankfully they don't anymore. That's one of the joys of being dead now, is that I can just see what happens each season, and I don't know what's going to happen next. And luckily my friends, they know to not tell me anything. Not that they would anyway, because HBO would kill them, but to not tell me what's going to happen. And I can just be a viewer now, which is a really great thing.
That is Richard Madden, who stars in the Netflix show Bodyguard. He was also Robb Stark in Game of Thrones, but check out Bodyguard if you haven't already. Richard Madden, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Move over, Perseids. It's the Geminids' turn. We're, of course, talking shooting stars, and the Geminid meteor shower is at its peak tonight and tomorrow. Let's bring in Kelly Beatty, senior editor at Sky and Telescope magazine. He joins us by Skype. Kelly, what exactly are these things?
So, you know, we see meteors in the sky all the time, shooting stars, but every once in a while, we pass through a concentration of them. We call that a meteor shower. These are caused by comets that are going around the sun. They get close to the sun. They spew off particles, and those particles get spread along the orbit. Every year when we pass through that comet's orbit, we get a pulse of meteors, and that's what we're going to get tonight and tomorrow.
And it seems like the Perseids, they come in August. They seem to get all the attention, but I am hearing that the Geminids are actually a better show.
You are correct. The Perseids come at a time when it's warm outside and people are out normally. It's colder now, right? And so fewer people are out at night. I'm here to tell you that the Geminids are much more dependable. If you're in a really dark spot, free from light pollution, you have a good chance of seeing a Geminid flash across the sky every minute or two. And that's quite impressive.
Well, and they appear to come from something that people like you, astronomers, call the radiant, a point in the sky in which they seem to come from. What are they coming from?
Well, they're coming from not a comet, which is what makes them unique. In this case, it's an asteroid. The asteroid is called Phaeton, and it has a really unusual orbit that brings it very close to the sun, where its surface gets heated up to more than 1,000 degrees. And literally, when that happens, the rock breaks down and spews all these particles along its orbit. And so instead of being caused by a comet, The Geminids are caused by this rock comet, Phaethon. And we call them Geminids because they appear to be radiating in the sky from a point in the constellation Gemini. Just like when you're driving in your car and the snow seems to be coming right at you, but you know it's really falling, it's the same sort of effect. And so Gemini is up above the horizon beginning around 7 or 8 o'clock. By 9 or 10 o'clock, you should be easily able to see them. If you could possibly stay up until after midnight, Gemini will be higher in the sky and we'll see more meteors either tonight or tomorrow night, depending on which is clearer for you.
Okay, remind me, Gemini, is that the twins or what's the constellation?
It is. It is the constellation of the twins, Gemini. And, you know, you don't need to worry about where it is in the sky. Literally, just look wherever your sky is darkest, because the meteors will appear all over the sky. If you trace their paths back, they will go back to the constellation of Gemini, but that's not really a concern. Just go for where it's darkest.
Okay. And times. Give us the best times across the country.
The same times apply no matter where you are. At least 9 or 10 o'clock I would go out. If you can stay out later, do that. The strongest peak should be tonight, but there'll be more of them tomorrow night as well. And, you know, these are really wonderful because you can just use your eyes. You don't need any kind of optical equipment. If you want more information, obviously, the Sky and Telescope is the place to go for all the information.
Or you can go to oursherenow.org. We'll link you. Kelly Beatty, Senior Editor at Sky and Telescope Magazine. Kelly, as you always say, look up.
Clear skies to you, Robin. Take care.
And tonight and tomorrow, you're looking up for the twins, Gemini.
Today, the Trump administration announced a new strategy to counter the influence of China and Russia in Africa. National Security Advisor John Bolton outlined the new strategy at the Heritage Foundation.
The predatory practices pursued by China and Russia stunt economic growth in Africa, threaten the financial independence of African nations, interfere with U.S. military operations, and pose a significant threat to U.S. national security interests.
Joining us now is NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Jeremy.
And when John Bolton says China and Russia are engaged in predatory practices in Africa, what is he saying that they're doing there?
Well, you know, China has really become a dominant force on the continent. It's invested heavily, built up infrastructure, but in a way that Bolton says is predatory. Countries, for instance, become very heavily indebted to China. He gave the examples of Zambia and Djibouti. And Djibouti is particularly of concern because the U.S. has a huge military base there, and China does now, too. And he said that's shifting the balance of power on the Horn of Africa. As for Russia, it's become more active in recent years, mostly through arms dealings in places like Central African Republic. It's not nearly as influential as it was in Soviet times, but the U.S. is watching this closely.
Well, and he said today that the U.S. will now be choosing its Africa partners more carefully under this new strategy. What does that mean?
Well, you know, this administration is looking for business opportunities for American companies and trade deals, and it's looking for ways to cut back on traditional aid programs. And I think that's kind of what he was talking about, that the U.S. doesn't want to just pour billions of dollars into aid programs that he doesn't think are paying off. But he didn't really say kind of what would be cut, and it's not at all clear that the U.S. can back away from some of the partners in the region that are security partners for the U.S.
Isn't this a little bit late to be coming up with this new strategy on Africa, in particular with China? They have been investing billions of dollars. We did a story not too long ago about a brand new high-speed train in East Africa that was paid for by the Chinese. Isn't it going to be hard to reverse the trend here?
Yeah, I mean, China's there and in a big way, as you say. I talked recently to the Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, Tibor Naj, and, you know, he said he can't blame Africans for doing all this business with China because it was the Chinese that were knocking on the door
right. For
so many years. And he says he just wants American companies to be there in the future. And the problem is the U.S. can't order its companies to go invest in China. They can only do it if the investment climate is right. But the pitch the Trump administration is making is, look, you know, U.S. investment will lead to jobs for Africans. And this is a continent that has, you know, a growing population, a lot of young people who have a lot of high expectations.
So that's the economic aspect to this. What about the military component? The U.S. has troops in Africa right now to fight terrorism. Is that going to change?
Well, I mean, the U.S., as we were talking before about the base in Djibouti, so it's obviously a concern. The U.S. wants to stay there. Bolton was also talking about this idea of getting countries in the region to take more ownership over their security. The U.S. has been working, for instance, with a group of five countries fighting terrorism in the Sahel region, and he kind of held that up as a model. He's not a fan of UN peacekeeping operations. He's looking to cut back support for peacekeeping missions, saying some of them aren't really working. So the idea is resolve conflicts, invest more in building up these locally owned troops that are going to be able to deal with these threats.
Michelle, in all of your reporting about diplomatic issues, how unusual is it for the focus, for a day at least, by the administration to be on Africa?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, it's always the kind of secondary issue for a lot of countries. But we've been hearing this for years, this idea of trade, not aid, getting more investment in Africa. And we always seem to be behind the curve, especially when it comes to China, which had a real vision for the region. This is what Bolton says they're trying to change, but we'll see if they can really put up the money or keep the focus.
One more thing I want to ask you about today. The Senate is really making its voice heard on U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia and its war in Yemen. This coming, of course, after the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. What are the implications here of the Senate speaking out like this?
Well, they don't want to stop U.S. counterterrorism efforts in Yemen, but they do want to stop the support for the Saudi-led coalition, which has been fighting for almost 4 years now to restore a government that was ousted by Iranian-backed rebels. The war has been devastating. Millions of people are on the brink of famine. I talked to an aid official this week who said, you know, U.S. fingerprints are all over that famine. So there's a real push now to end this war. And there's a little bit of hopeful sign out of UN-mediated talks because they agreed at least to a ceasefire at a key port.
That's NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, a story now about a fungal disease that has killed off millions of bats across North America. Since white nose syndrome was first identified in 2006, it spread to bats in more than 30 states and eastern Canada. As Connecticut Public Radio's Patrick Scahill reports, scientists are trying to learn more about the impact of this devastating disease by listening to the calls of the bats left behind.
If a bat flies in a forest and no one's around to hear it, does it make a sound? Well, not a sound our ears can hear. That's a little brown bat, bouncing high-pitched sounds off a surface to navigate and find food. It's called echolocation. The call is slowed down and pitch-shifted so our ears can hear it. Chris Wisniewski says in Connecticut, that sound used to be a lot more common.
Pre-white nose syndrome, it would have been just as common as the big brown bat. We saw them to a smaller extent, but nowhere near their pre-white nose syndrome numbers.
Wisniewski teaches biology at Southern Connecticut State University, and he's pretty clued into bat calls. Last year, he set up microphones all over the state, recording hundreds of hours of them. The idea was to figure out what bats are out there and what they're doing.
There's really not much known on Connecticut bats, especially now post-white nose syndrome.
White nose is a fungus that affects bats when they hibernate. It gets on their skin and causes bats to do odd things, like fly around in the winter.
Because of that fungus, they're waking up from hibernation. It's, you know, causing them to use all that energy. They're losing their fat stores, and they're not able to bounce back from that. It's really quite devastating.
So what is it about those bats that do bounce back?
We're really starting to turn our attention to these surviving bats. What are they doing differently? What can we learn from them?
Miranda Dunbar is an associate professor of biology at Southern Connecticut State University who advised Wisniewski's research. She says over the years, scientists have developed computer programs cataloging lots of echolocation calls. Think of it like a dictionary for bat speak.
It's a library of sorts. And so we can plug in our recordings of an echolocation call, and the software will match that with the known and try to match the species together.
And from that, Dunbar says, you can learn a lot about bats.
Based on the types of calls, we can figure out what exactly are they doing in those areas? How are they using that habitat?
Like this eastern red bat, a migratory species which popped up at microphones Wisniewski put near bodies of water on the edges of forest. Or this big brown bat, recorded feeding at a state park. It was by far the bat Wisniewski recorded the most.
They'll send out search and approach calls. But as they close in on something, or specifically an insect, they'll send out really a rapid pulse rate of their echolocation call. It's really, really rapid pulses, and it almost kind of sounds like a...
As he recorded around the state, Wisniewski says getting lots of big brown bats confirmed other surveys in the region, and hints that big brown bats, with their larger fat reserves, appear to be better at shaking off white nose. And now that the little brown bats are essentially gone, Wisniewski says his research raises another question.
Are other species moving in and utilizing these ecological niches once held by that species? So are the big brown bats now moving into habitat types and taking over the role, ecological role, of the little brown bat and other species that are much less common post-white nose syndrome?
Dunbar says learning more about those survivors is the next step for bat research.
We spend so much time talking about those that have died, but there are a few species and a few individuals that are surviving this disease. They must be doing something special. They must have something special that allows them to do this.
And while Dunbar isn't optimistic white nose syndrome will be cured anytime soon, she's hopeful bat acoustic data will continue to unlock more secrets about the bat's weathering white nose. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Scahill.
The Oakland Raiders are mired in a miserable season. Just 3 wins, 10 losses. The Raiders are in last place in the AFC West. And this is just the first season of a 10-year, $100 million contract for head coach John Gruden. And now the Raiders may have some more bills to pay because the city of Oakland is suing the team and the NFL over the Raiders' plan to relocate to Las Vegas in 2020. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
So Oakland, the city, says that Oakland, the team, and the NFL formed an illegal cartel, you know, to sort of grease the skids and help the Raiders in this move to Las Vegas. How would the NFL do that, and why would they do that?
Okay, maybe that cartel imagery or idea is a little bit of a reach. So to back up, the Raiders are planning to move to Las Vegas, mm-hmm. and Oakland was spurned by all of this, and Oakland invested in the Raiders being there and mm-hmm. feels like a little bit jilted. And also, they make the argument that they have some actionable legal remedies. So what they're saying is that the Raiders were allowed by the NFL to move to Las Vegas as long as they paid a fee of over $300 million. Oof. So it's sort of like a shakedown where one member of the quote-unquote cartel pays off the other ones, and then they get to break contracts with Oakland and Oakland Alameda Stadium, County Stadium. There's mm-hmm. a lot of irony going on here because under Mark Davis, the current Raiders, under his father, Al Davis, the owner of the Raiders, Al Davis was the most litigious man in professional sports. And he would sue the NFL and do whatever he wanted. Mm-hmm. And at one point, he even won an antitrust lawsuit against the NFL. So now it's a little taste of his own medicine.
Well, but I got a question. So this is all in 2020 that this proposed move was supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
If in fact, you know, so this lawsuit's going along, how does that impact the move? And where do the Raiders go next year?
Right. So how does it impact the move? This suit is actually not about the move. The suit is not asking anyone to block the move.
Okay.
It's asking for payments because of the move.
Okay.
But the Raiders were planning on staying in Oakland and paying the stadium and paying the city. And now the owner, Mark Davis, says, I don't really feel great about paying them $3, $4, $5 million. But, you know, I'd hate to do it to the fans. Right. Because he cares so much about the fans
that
of Oakland.
Leaving.
That's why he's leaving. Right. That's why his father left for Los Angeles. That's why, you know, he's in this like decades long fight with every municipality that would or wouldn't have him. So, yeah, it could complicate things. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it'll just, you know, up the asking price for Oakland. They'll get a few million more dollars out of this.
Okay.
Mike, let's put our eyes to the sky now and talk about something else in the sports world this week. NBA star Steph Curry was on a podcast with some other players. They were talking about conspiracy theories, and Curry expressed doubt that the moon landing really happened. Let's listen.
We ever been to the moon?
Nope.
Nope.
They're going to come get us. I don't think so either.
Elon Musk.
Sorry, I don't start the conspiracies.
They ain't been on the moon.
You don't think so?
So Curry now says he was joking, and he's going to visit NASA. But tell us what's going on here.
Yeah, his fellow astrophysicists on that podcast, Kent Bazemore and Vince Carter, didn't seem to strongly disagree with him. I have such admiration for Steph Curry. He seems to comport himself in a very dignified and kind of forward-looking way off the court. Just a couple of weeks ago, a young girl wrote into him and said, I'd like to buy your shoes, but they don't come in girl sizes.
Yes.
Right. The brilliant letter he wrote back, and he invited her to games, and he said, we're correcting this. So I wouldn't say I put the guy on a pedestal. He's one of the most exciting players. But it's like, well, there's a guy that, as a fan, I think mostly positive things about.
But what about the fact that this is not the first time something like this has happened? Kyrie Irving said the Earth is flat, but then backed off and apologized to science teachers.
But he went around for a long time saying the Earth was flat.
People really look up to these guys. Yeah. And when
this
they
is
say
what I
stuff like, yeah,
I think
ahead.
Kyrie Irving really did believe that, or to the extent that he had strong beliefs, he wasn't kidding. I have no idea if Steph Curry was kidding. I don't know why. I don't exactly know what the joke was there. I don't know why the other two guys agreed with him. But I find this disturbing. Am I so uncool to think that of exactly what you said, Jeremy, that a prominent guy who little kids and teenagers and maybe even adults like me look up to could say this and normalize a wackadoo conspiracy theory? Maybe it's because I'm a stuck-in-the-mud journalist, but I don't like even giving voice to these theories. And if this seems funny and benign, we have seen so many instances where the infection of nonfiction with conspiracy thought truth in the real world has had terrible consequences. So I really didn't love this. I would much rather have my NBA players, you know, being fascinated by lunar modules or something having to do and rooted in actual science.
And at least Steph Curry now says he will happily accept NASA's invitation to tour the lunar lab at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst and editor of the book Upon Further Review, The Greatest What Ifs in Sports History. What if Steph Curry
was right.
Oh my God.
not right. Mike, thanks. Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.